This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's Fun Friday. My name is Jeff Sandhu. Now, regular listeners to this show will know that Culture Pop's Matt Armitage is obsessed with the vision of the world where toasters are chatting to each other online and playing internet poker with your money. He is, of course, insane. But who does the Internet of Things really benefit? Us or the man? And here for a closer look is...
Hey, Jeff. Yeah, I wish I had Seth Meyers' ratings, or at least his writers. Mm. You lot might get some better jokes instead of my terrible ones. We talk about the Internet of Things a lot on the show, yeah. But we don't often say what we mean by the Internet of Things. This idea of toasters connected to the internet is kind of a running joke.
But they're real, though.
Somehow they're quite real.
It turned out to be real.
Yeah, but the Internet of Things, in its kind of simplest form, is really an attempt to put the world online. So we're talking about kind of chips and sensors that talk to each other. They also talk to control centers, and via those control centers, they talk to us. Basically, if you think about anything that uses electricity being connected to everything else that uses electricity. Mm. It sounds a little bit far-fetched. It sounds a little bit silly, but that is actually the logical conclusion of the direction that we're going in. We're already seeing it in a lot of places. We're seeing connected light bulbs. We're seeing this technology in cars. We're seeing it in alarm clocks, in kids' toys. Basically, if it runs on electricity, it can be sensorized.
Mm.
And it's kind of evolving into this Internet of Things philosophy. It's this vision of a connected and an ordered world that's run by some kind of machine intelligence. Now, depending on who you talk to, this is either a utopian future that will set us all free, or it's going to be some kind of dystopian nightmare where robots are going to be policing us on the streets and smacking us on the back of the head when we fail to do enough slave labor for them.
Now, we've spoken about this, understanding, you know, technology from a technology standpoint. Do we need to know how IoT works?
No, not really. I mean, it's more important to know what the Internet of Things is and what the implications are for you. Because really, we don't know how most of our technology works. As we demonstrated on a show back in February, most people don't know how electricity works. So when it comes to something like the internet, you've really got very little chance. In fact, most people, including myself, struggle to tell the difference between the World Wide Web and the internet, because so much of our technology is actually invisible to us. We use the internet all the time. I've got it on my computer in front of me, but we don't actually see the internet. We don't see the pipes and the servers and the information. And the thing is, we don't really think about how those ones and zeros turn into the page that we see in front of us. We just take it for granted.
And make it into an image and all that.
Exactly. The images and the words and the design, all of those things is just ones and zeros. And it's the same with cars as well. You know, we assume that we're the ones doing the driving when we turn the steering wheel, but it's not true. In most cars now, it's actually when you touch the steering wheel, the brake, the accelerator, it goes to a CPU, and the CPU is what actually controls the car. So that sensation, that feeling of control, is actually fake. Our vehicles are already remote control machines, and the idea that we have control over them is essentially a false one. So yeah, going back to the question, it's not really essential that we know how these things work, but we do need to know what it means for our lives, for our homes, and for our societies. Mm.
Essentially, we're talking about nearly everything being connected to something else. And that itself is just pretty enormous. Can we sort of break it down a little bit then?
Sure. Because, you know, that toaster or that light bulb, yes, they're obviously a part of the Internet of Things. But so is something like Uber, because the app is also the command center, the clearinghouse. It's the point of sale system for the driver. It's a customer feedback channel. It's a navigation system. So once we start getting outside our own homes, that Internet of Things becomes a lot more complex. So yes, we will keep it simple. We will break it down a bit. I think a lot of people will find that quite helpful. So I've borrowed these categories from a Guardian article called Rise of the Machines. Mm. And it's an adaptation from a new book called Radical Technologies by a guy called Adam Greenfield. And again, this idea of radical technologies is one that I think we're going to be coming back to a fair bit over the next few weeks. So Greenfield splits the Internet of Things down into three main categories, most of which people will know. So there's our bodies. That's things like wearables, Fitbits, that kind of thing, right. Apple Watch, mm-hmm. the technology that enhances our performance or our senses, those kind of devices. Then there's the technology for where we live, you know, things that help us to develop smart homes. And then there's things that relate to public spaces, so these kind of smart cities approaches. Like I said, I don't think that's really new to anyone. Mm. But I think what might be new to people is the realization of who these kind of devices really benefit. And again, what the implications of following this sort of current IoT philosophy actually could be. Mm. So, for example, you know, we're creating this command and control structure with devices that we actually only nominally command and control. So forget the idea of, you know, Big Brother. It's actually Big Bot that we're heading towards. We've got algorithms that do what we want them to do, but only because a corporation somewhere has told them that they have to.
Yeah.
Because we own the hardware, but we don't own the software. So if we go back to Juicer, which is my current obsession last week. So, you know, it's a juice maker that won't juice unless you meet a set of terms and conditions. You have to have your juice bag verified by a QR code, and it needs to be connected to the internet. And of course, if everything is like that, that's a very dangerous world. That means, you know, do you have to scan your water bill if you want to take a shower? Or do you need to get permission from the microwave to feed your baby? You know, these are all kind of outcomes that are not really in our best interest.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but let's start by having a look at your body.
Thank you, Jeff. Yes, my body is 100% organic. It has not been enhanced. In fact, in the most part, it's degraded and deteriorated. Just as an aside, I was actually at a hospital this week for a checkup, and they had this amazing poster of prosthetic and orthotic devices. And honestly, these things look like the limbs of a Terminator robot. Oh. You know, they're skeletal and frightening. But really, what they represent is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of where we're going with this kind of technology. The next generation of these things will actually have the prosthetics communicating straight with the brain and operating far more like a natural limb. But anyway, we'll start with something a bit simpler than enhanced humans. if we go back to wearables, so your Fitbit, your fitness tracker, yes, they give you good feedback. They're tracking your fitness, your steps, your sleep, your heart rate. But it's also giving feedback to the company that makes that device as well. Mm. Again, it's that idea that you own the device but not the data. Mm. And although it's generally anonymized, it doesn't have to be, because don't forget, when you download that app, you download it from an app store that contains your name and your password and all your financial details. Mm. So, you know, it being anonymized is not something that you should take for granted. I've used this example on the show before. What if your medical insurer makes it compulsory that you have to wear one of these devices, to wear a fitness tracker, and they're actually assessing you in real time? They could actually be making constant adjustments to your policy rate according to the data you're getting. Yeah. You could be paying a different rate literally day by day. Mm. And of course, if you take it off or you lose it or damage it, does that mean you lose your coverage? Mm. And that's just for the kind of wearables that we have now. All sorts of new technologies are, you know, just around the corner. I mentioned kind of enhancement before. Not necessarily, you know, cutting off a healthy hand or a leg and replacing it with like some robot part. But we're talking about devices that can store and stream your memories in high definition. Ooh, that's something we've talked about on the show before. Yeah, exactly. Chips and screens that could enhance your sight and add a data overload. So an overlay rather. So not so much Google Glass, but literally Google Eye, replacing the lens on your eye. Microcontrollers that replace worn out hip or knee joints, hearing implants that can be tuned to ignore or receive certain frequencies, or even fingertip sensors that give kind of increased sensitivity feedback. They could read barometric pressure. They might even have an RFID-enabled touch-and-go type payment card linked to an e-wallet, again, just in the tip of your finger. So there's all sorts of devices for this kind of purpose that are both incredible and very boring or very mundane. And a lot of this technology is currently being devised to handle, you know, physical or mental impairments, but it is a lot like defense technology. A lot of it is dual use. So, you know, the US military didn't think they were developing GPS to put it into a phone my pocket in this studio. But the devices that restore sight to the blind will probably also be able to enhance the sight of people who are healthy. And that's before we even get into things like replacement organs, which are probably going to be some mixture of biological and robotic. There's that gross movie with Forrest Whitaker and Jude Law, Repo Men, which
good
completely
movie,
grossed
but
me out.
Very, very gross, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's about guys who cut replacement organs out of the people who fall behind on their payments. Yeah. And is that going to be our future? Maybe not that bloody, but leasing parts of our body from corporations, large parts of our bodies being owned by corporations. And that's why these kind of discussions about privacy and security, I think, are so important, because right now hackers are only trying to take over your computer or your phone. In a few years, it could be your eyeballs, or even threatening to wipe out the memories you've got stored on an HD chip.
Yeah, just thinking about, like you mentioned, you know, these devices that we buy, the Fitbits and the Apple Watches and the smartphones and all, we assume we own the device, but we don't actually own the data that we create that makes the device
not
a device.
And yes, it's generated by us, but it's not our data. If you look in the terms and conditions for a lot of them, if you want to retrieve data, they have no obligation to give you any of the information that is generated about you.
And then when it comes to organs, it's just freaky because it's in your body, and even though you paid, you know, thousands for that organ, you may actually not own
it is a worry.
It is a worry. Yet again, it's supposed to be a fun Friday, but Matt's just...
Hey, this is fun.
It's like a scary Friday, and we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back with more scary stuff with Matt Armitage, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
And we're back, and this is Fun Friday, or slightly scary Fun Friday, with the Culture Pop's Matt Armitage. We're talking about Internet of Things. And earlier on, just before we went on to the break, we were talking about the Internet of Things in our body, the organs that will be connected. And also, assuming, Matt, that we're all, you know, still in control of our bodies, what are some of the implications of smart home technology?
Well, on the face of it, connecting all these different bits of your home to each other makes a lot of sense. Smart technology can definitely make our homes easier and cheaper to run. You know, you can have sensors all over the place which are feeding back information about heat loss or heat retention. You can have bots crawling through your pipes, through your electric cables, looking for faults to report. Mm-hmm. You've got machines that switch themselves on at certain times of the day to make use of the cheapest power, door locks that you open with your phone, medicine cupboards that will only open with a retinal scan or a thumbprint, and they take an inventory of the usage and the dosage. There's a lot of useful stuff in there, but there's another layer of this that seems just to be designed to sell us stuff. So, for example, the Amazon makes those little dash buttons that allow you to order one thing with a single push of the button. So you just stick the button somewhere when you run out of
milk
or toilet roll or washing powder or whatever. You just press the button.
Yep.
And it's very convenient. But however convenient it is to you, it's a lot more convenient to Amazon. First, this kind of technology helped them to deal with inventory, so they can be a lot more efficient in the way that they store store and purchasing from suppliers. It also gives Amazon a lot of information on the times of day and the kind of circumstances that lead you to make your purchase, which can again help them to decide how and when to communicate with you and what kind of offers they give you. It's also very good at locking you into a particular product. A lot of us are genuinely brand loyal, but Amazon can actually nudge you towards products that give them the best margins, yeah, not necessarily give you the best deal. So, for example, dash buttons are only available for certain products, not every product. So there's a couple of brands of orange juice, there's a couple of brands of washing powder. It's not the full range.
Yeah.
So it narrows your choice towards the ones that the retailer prefers. And then, of course, we have the smart home controllers themselves, which are constantly listening in, you know, your Google Home, your Amazon Echo being among the leaders here. And if it seems like I'm kind of singling Amazon out here, it's partly because their Echo products, they are kind of ahead of the game. Google Home is a kind of newcomer, but they're starting to catch up. Apple, I think, will probably plan to sell you a white cube with no doors or buttons that somehow will be your actual home. There'll be a walled garden, obviously.
They did come up with a speaker recently in the WWDC as well.
Yeah, so they'll just make a bigger version of that that you can live inside. But these controllers, they're capable of listening to and watching all kinds of behavior. And all of that is marshaled towards selling you stuff because, you know, we already know that the price that we see online isn't the price. It's the price for me. It's the price that's based on my browsing history and all the other harvested information that I've given to retailers in the past. And they can then determine if a person is an impulse buyer who will pay more or a spendthrift who needs to be nudged via email or text with, you know, a discount coupon. So as an example, I think back in 2012, the travel site Orbitz, it discovered that Mac users were prepared to spend 30% more on average on hotel rooms than people who used Windows computers. So its prices or its choices could be adjusted accordingly to push them towards higher priced inventory. And of course, you know, as soon as you hit a site, it can tell what browser you're using, it can tell what operating system that you're being accessed by.
Wow.
So, you know, there's all of this kind of information that we don't think about that retailers are able to harvest that put together a picture about us.
And that's why I use incognito mode whenever I'm, you know, doing like flight bookings and hotel bookings because, you know, it's just, it gives you different prices. But anyways,
it does, but I think it disables some of the cookies, but it will probably still say that you're accessing on Safari or Chrome from a Mac or a Windows.
And this information we generate at home, would it follow us around?
Yeah, a bit of a tangent here, but I think it's still relevant. A lot of us are familiar with Uber and its surge pricing model. Yes, but apparently supermarkets are also itching to get into the surge pricing business. So electronic price tags on shelves are already being used in a lot of countries, especially in Europe. So they're digital readout displays that can be instantly changed.
Wow.
So they can actually be updated or tweaked thousands of times an hour as supply and demand fluctuates. I think one article I read said that a supermarket in chain in France was able to change prices 90,000 times a day. Yeah, just making, you know, very, very small transactional differences. So at peak times, that could mean higher prices, especially on staples, you know, bread, milk, those kind of things. And of course, for fresh produce, it allows discounts to be made to avoid wastage. Of course, along with that, you get a lot more personalized pricing, again, on the kind of Amazon-type model. And that means knowing what it will take to get you to switch from one brand to another brand that the retailer has a better margin on. Again, that could be via instant coupons, in-store discounts, but all these little nudges that push you towards the products they want you to take rather than the ones you intended to actually buy. And of course, if you are also a member of that particular retailer's loyalty program, or maybe you're using an e-wallet to pay, then the store knows who you are and they have that background information, all of that stuff that's been harvested by Alexa or Google or Siri and all the other marketing companies. And all of that comes to bear on the price that you see on the tag when you pick up a bottle of orange juice. They say that this kind of flexible pricing has allowed some stores to reduce food waste by up to 30%, which is great. And it also has allowed those same stores to boost profitability by several percentage points, which could be because of that reduced wastage, but it could also be because they're providing less value to individual customers and consumers. Mm.
Now, assuming that any of us dares to leave the home after, you know, listening to us talking about this, what does IoT have in store for us in the world at large?
Well, I'm not coming down on smart cities. I think by and large, it's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But we are back in the land of big bot. For a smart city to really function, everything has to be watched and observed. It's like opening those weird tools on your computer that tell you what processes the CPU is currently running and how much of the system's resources that they're using, which none of us actually understand. But smart cities are like that. It's a system for the places we live. So the water, the power, the traffic lights, the street corners, the bike lanes, the parking spaces, all of it has to light up like, you know, circuits in the brain. There's neurons and there's positrons and there's alphrons and there's dodurons and everything else that makes it clear that I haven't got a clue what I'm talking about. But all of those circuits have to be analyzed and cross-referenced in real time. Yeah. And it's amazing how complicated those data intersections and interactions become. So, for example, the system will have to guess how many people are likely to get off at the next MRT stop, get off a train at the next MRT stop, and what impact that's going to have on, say, pedestrian crossings or traffic flow on the roads surrounding the station. Mm. It's got to, say, determine what the power surge in a business district is going to be if everyone comes back from lunch at the same time. Mm. And, of course, there's the privacy issue. Is every IoT-connected traffic light registering that you're passing at an individual level, and is that going into a big database somewhere? Mm. So there's a when you have all this information, you have to wonder what information is being put where.
And let's say privacy isn't the issue. Isn't a smart city the obvious solution to the kind of, you know, road and travel chaos that we see in KL?
Yeah, it can be and it will be, but it's not the whole of the story. When we think about this, we assume that the algorithms controlling this are neutral, that they're not political, they're not manipulative like we are as human beings. And this is something that Adam Greenfield brings up in his book that I hadn't really given enough thought to, because the algorithms aren't neutral. We've discussed this in the past in the case of like financial crises. We don't really understand what the algorithms are doing or even quite what they were designed to do in the first place. And it's kind of the same with smart cities. If you look at traffic, currently we program traffic lights to work in the favor of specific directions because somebody has determined which destination is more important than another one. And of course, any algorithm is going to be programmed to reflect those same colored or political choices, which, of course, favour some people over others.
And that's all because resources are limited?
Well, again, all those things we mentioned, the water, the power, the traffic lights, the street corners, the bike lanes, the parking spaces. You know, take the parking space. Who decides how a parking space is allocated? Hmm. Do you get directed to a parking space because it's the closest one to you or because you work at a hedge fund that, you know, that provides a lot of the city taxes? In periods of, say, peak demand, does the water supply get diverted from residential units to factories that won't be able to work without the water? Or what about the internet? Does speed get throttled to domestic connections so that big companies won't get slowed down? Mm. Because, again, as Greenfield points out, algorithms love logic. They like linear outcomes. But cities are not linear places because they're full of illogical and multilinear human beings. So there's a definite possibility that that decision-making, that resource allocation, it could end up favoring a wealthy few over the less kind of well-heeled masses. There was a story I saw last week for self-driving cars. they were saying that highways could have an additional tiered payment lane for these cars. Your automated car negotiates onto that lane and the traffic is controlled, and you're able to travel at a much faster speed, which reduces your journey time. And the guys behind the project have won a lot of prizes, a lot of recognition. There's a lot of interest from Silicon Valley. But the thing is, this is like we were talking about the other week. This isn't an innovation. This is actually just the future of self-driving cars. This is what they should automatically be heading for. Yeah. I think you've mentioned on the show in the past, Volvo and other car companies have been researching this kind of behavior and similar ideas for high-speed road trains. The software and the city and the highways management system should be doing this kind of high-speed lane stuff automatically. Having a dedicated lane that you pay extra for is just an unnecessary premium layer, especially when, you know, highways are already charging you tolls to go slowly in traffic. So there's absolutely no need for this service. It simply serves to charge an unjustified additional fee to an unnecessary corporation. It's basically juicer for self-driving cars.
So what's your verdict on IoT then?
I mean, this is something that we all need to decide on. As Adam Greenfield puts it, the technology tends towards a single solution with a single direction. But we're not machines. Our cities, our lives, they don't have these easy remedies. They don't have these binary choices. One of the things about a lot of the Internet of Things devices that we currently use is that we just passively accept the terms and conditions that the companies set. We accept that we own the device, but not the software. We accept that we don't own our own data. And we aren't sure how much these kind of companies are taking from us in terms of information. When it comes to dynamic pricing, I have to say I hate it. As a foreigner in Malaysia, I've been subject to dynamic pricing for nearly 20 years. And I can tell you from experience, it's never in my favor. And the same goes for smart cities. You know, in order to ensure that these are smart choices for us, we have to be engaged. We have to be vocal. It's very easy to get wrapped up in the shiny packaging of all of this. These services are supposed to make our lives better. They're not just supposed to make some people's lives better. Because when we talk about Internet of Things, the majority of people, they don't have a smart toaster. They don't take Uber. They don't know that algorithms are being used to manage their daily commute. They don't know that they are already part of the Internet of Things. So it's important that the Internet of Things is actually run to benefit all of these people and not to exclude them, because we're very much at the start of the journey with this kind of technology, and we have to decide now whether we want it to be inclusive or exclusive. Because if you do decide you want it to be exclusive, the chances are you're going to be one of the people that is excluded from it. Because the thing about the few and the many is, even if you think you're part of the few, most of the few think you're part of the many.
Oh, so all about the Internet of Things train then, I guess.
Again, just making decisions.
All right. Matt Armitage from Culture Pop will stick around for Geek Squawks after this. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.